You're listening to Podnosis, the pulse of the healthcare industry. I'm your host, Ayla Ellison. Science tells us that things like diet and exercise matter for good health. What about arts and culture? Decades of research show that engaging in the arts can have a profound, positive impact on health. Yet, it is not widely recognized by patients and providers as medicine. Social prescribing is an emerging movement in healthcare, where providers can recommend personalized doses of arts and culture as part of a care plan. Fierce Healthcare's Anastasia Gliakoskia sat down with two leaders in this space to talk about the power of the arts and their role in the next generation of mental health treatment. In the first segment, she chats with Dr. Tasha Golden, Director of Research at the International Arts and Mind Lab at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Let's dive into the conversation now.
Tell me a bit about yourself and how you got into the space, why you're passionate about what you're doing.
Yes, this work that I'm doing now was never the plan, but I am passionate about it. I started my career as a singer-songwriter. That's the job that I had dreamt of doing since I was a really little girl. I wanted to write songs and travel the world and play them, and I got to do that. Songs and TV and film, got to work with really amazing musicians. But during that time, I found that songs that I was writing about really difficult personal experiences, like my history of major depression or my family's history of domestic violence, those were always the songs that people lined up after concerts wanting to talk about. And a lot of people shared their own stories with me based on my songs, stories of their mental illnesses or suicide ideation or their own histories of abuse, often following it up by saying that I'm the first person they had ever told. And I knew as I heard that just all over the world, well, that means that they're not telling a doctor or a therapist. It means that the community services and resources that are ostensibly designed to meet the needs of people with these kinds of histories clearly are not reaching these individuals. So what was it about a music venue or a singer or a song that made those stories speakable for the first time? And I saw that same thing happen when I founded Project Uncaged. It's a trauma-informed creative writing program for girls that are incarcerated. And it doesn't usually surprise people to hear that girls share really different information in their poems and songs than they share on questionnaires or surveys or in other spaces. And so it was, again, just really apparent to me, there is a lot that we don't know about people and about experiences, because there are ways people need to be able to express those experiences in certain ways that the arts often makes available to them. And when you ask somebody, for example, to disclose something or share something in a really forthright, linear way, that might not be available to them, or they just might not prefer to try to go into their story in a way that's so limited and constrained. And so I got really interested in what do we not know and how the arts can bridge the gap between what becomes possible for people to share and bear witness to in the space of the arts, and what's obviously not yet possible for a lot of us in other spaces, whether that's clinics or schools or workplaces or even our homes. So I pulled on the thread of that question till I had a PhD in public health specializing in the impacts of the arts and culture and aesthetics on what we know and how we heal in our general individual well-being, but also collective and community well-being.
Wow. Well, what a powerful personal example, personal story of, I feel like how a lot of people end up in the healthcare space is just noticing an experience that they or a loved one have, wanting to do something to fix a problem that clearly there's such a big need for. Mental health is obviously, this country is in a mental health crisis right now. So talk about what you do at the International Arts and Mind Lab at Johns Hopkins and what your research looks at.
Yeah, the lab in general researches the intersections of arts, really broadly understood. Anything that you might imagine can fit under the umbrella of arts, that's included. And health, again, really broadly understood, anything that might fit under that. So the lab's purview is very broad, and we have been doing studies of how music, for example, is being used to address serious mental illness. We've done studies of how literature can be used to help young people dialogue and learn more about mental illness. We're also a collaborating center with the World Health Organization looking at the effects of arts and culture on the global youth mental health crisis, starting our research in the United States. And a lot of those are mental health focused because, as you might imagine, there is such a, well, just as you mentioned, there is a crisis right now that people are trying to figure out how to address. And people are looking at the fact that if we keep doing things the way that we have been doing them, we're going to get the same results. How can we get more creative and innovative in how we're approaching this? And then also, as far as equity goes and just responding to people's lives and needs, how can we tap into the ways that communities and cultures have gone about addressing their mental well-being and their social connections for centuries? How can we tap into that and learn from that to better our processes and solutions now?
Well, I would love to talk about that. Communities, I would imagine, across the board nationally have certain centers of culture or art, places where people congregate and enjoy live theater, live music. How do you think those resources are or are not currently being leveraged by communities around the country?
That's such a great question, and it's a big impetus for the work around social prescribing, or what we sometimes call arts on prescription, is exactly that kind of conundrum of, it's not that these assets and opportunities have to be created so much, or sometimes they do, but oftentimes they're sitting there doing their work either at a really small scale or they haven't been supported, and so they're not able to do their work. So how can we tap into these opportunities? So to your point, there are oftentimes even large institutions and communities. You can imagine communities that might have a symphony or museum or ballet or things like that, that have been like historically fine arts institutions and communities. And those institutions do a lot of good for communities. Like you said, they are gathering places, they offer aesthetic beauty, they offer ways for people to get in touch with an emotional aspect of themselves. Or sometimes it can be as small as they can give people something to talk about with one another. People come together in the same place and now they have this shared experience that they can talk about that can create a social connection that might not have existed otherwise. But those institutions are not often considered to be part of the health landscape of a community and are often left off the table when it comes to communities. You might imagine, whether it's social work or public health or community large healthcare systems, when they're thinking about what might we need to refer our patients to or our clients to that could benefit their health in the community, it's not often that these kinds of institutions come up. And then it's really important to say that there are so many very hyper-local arts activities, arts initiatives, cultural initiatives in communities that don't get the attention and the funding of these large cultural institutions, like what I mentioned, museums, symphonies, and things like that, that are incredibly important to people's lives. It can be the dance instructor down the street who's taught dance in her living room for decades, and the people who come through there are bettered by their experience with dance, or maybe that person is a really wonderful mentor to a lot of young people in the community. And that, and so in this kind of work of connecting arts with health, it's really been important in all of our messaging to make sure that we're thinking in terms of what are these large sort of obvious institutions and how can we re-see them, recognize them as part of our health networks? And then also, how can we make sure, as far as equity goes, cultural relevance, and just tapping into our many assets in our communities, how can we make sure that we also include these beautiful examples of arts initiatives and arts participation and engagement that has allowed so many communities to connect with each other and to thrive over time?
Well, that's a really beautiful idea. And I guess from the perspective of social prescribing, that type of work would presumably start with the provider, right? The healthcare provider. Can you talk about what you think their role is in encouraging this type of engagement with patients and maybe some of the efforts that you have tracked that have been successful, like maybe examples of providers really actively doing this for a while?
Yeah. Well, it's different from community to community because in the United States, obviously, our system is very cobbled together and different by regions. And so some physicians and other kinds of providers are able to refer somebody to, for example, a kind of case manager or connector who can then listen to that patient and then get a sense of what in the community might be most beneficial to that person based on their needs and based on their interests. But of course, a lot of communities don't have that. And in that case, we are looking at what kinds of infrastructures can be set up, and Art Pharmacy has done this kind of work, but what kinds of infrastructure can be set up to make this process as easy on the providers as possible? Because what we see this as and what so many providers have reflected back to us that they see this as is they are so good at so many things for their patients. But when it comes to things like a patient who's lonely, a patient whose quality of life is just diminished, a patient who just doesn't feel like they have a kind of reason to live or a sense of meaning, there aren't many tools in the physician's toolkit to address those kinds of issues. That we hear from providers a lot of times that the most they feel like they can do is offer a little bit of advice, but they don't actually have a concrete action that they can take on behalf of that patient. And so where we see arts on prescription or social prescribing playing such a big role for providers themselves is that it's finally giving them a way to address these kinds of needs that they haven't had any ways to address before. And so a lot of times it's very intuitive for providers. They're listening to somebody talk about feeling disconnected. And so maybe they're thinking about how might I recommend something that could create some social engagement or a way to make friends with people with like interests. Or it can be like, oh, this person doesn't seem to be thriving. How might I help them get out and about? How might I help them get back in touch with something that maybe used to interest them or a new interest, or maybe just get them out in nature? And now there are some ways for providers to build on that intuition that most of them already have, but then concretely connect their patient to a way to take up that recommendation that's in most cases free to the patient. So maybe that's an access, a park pass to local park system or even to zoos. Sometimes it's tickets to museums. Sometimes it's a series of music classes or dance classes. There's all kinds of things based on what happens to be present in that community.
Do you think that from like a behavioral psychology standpoint, having this type of prescription or having this directive from a healthcare provider to engage in this type of programming is more effective for some people than just having it be recommended generally as part of a care plan or not even in the context of a healthcare setting, but say someone in their family or someone they know recommends that they do this type of thing? Do you think that it's maybe more effective to hear it from a healthcare professional?
It certainly has been for some people that we have talked to. And sometimes the way that they've described it is a kind of sense of permission. Like, this might be something that interests me, but I am, especially in our society, it's such a kind of hustle culture. You're only of value if you're being productive and productivity is defined in such limited ways, right? So for a lot of people, they might think to themselves like, well, maybe it would be nice to go for a hike in the nearest park or something like that. But who has the time? I shouldn't go and do that. I should be more productive. I should be doing this instead. And so in those cases, when a provider says this is actually really great for your health or your mental well-being, and it has benefits X, Y, Z, then sometimes that's like the permission or the extra push that somebody might need. And then of course, for other people, it's literally an issue of access. Some of the arts on prescription programs that we've seen, including in Massachusetts, when we were first evaluating their work, one of the biggest barriers that they faced was transportation. So there's the initial barrier of costs. If somebody can't afford to get into a museum or can't afford to go see the play, they're not going to be able to go. So the programs can eliminate that cost for them if they get a prescription or referral. But then there's these other barriers of, but do they have time in their lives if they're working three jobs? Can they get there if they live in a rural area, especially? But we've seen some really wonderful work to work with all kinds of different agencies in different cities and regions and like creative grant processes where people are getting funding to make sure that these barriers are removed. And I'll just say to your question earlier, you mentioned what are some examples of providers using this. An example that I really love from the Culture RX program in Massachusetts is that a lot of individual mental health therapists were using this kind of programming to help initiate new conversations with their patients. So they're able to give their patients or clients tickets to a museum, for example, and then they can come back the next week and talk about, what did you see? How did that reflect what we've been talking about? And finding new ways into new conversations that way. Mm. And then, super interesting, I'll just throw out that museum, the Clark, also offered a coupon for a free drink, or I think it was just a free item from their cafe. Mm-hmm. And what we heard from the therapist was that was such a big deal for their clients who took up the chance to go to the museum, because it was a way for them to invite a friend, come to the museum with me, we'll go to the cafe, we'll both get a free item. And so for some people who had been isolated or couldn't get themselves to leave the house or call a friend, this gave them a really targeted way to take that really big step. And it was just a matter of here's some tickets to a museum, and here's a free coffee. Mm-hmm. And it just opened up so many opportunities for their clients.
That's wonderful. Obviously, getting this reimbursed is a whole conversation in and of itself. But what do you think is the future of getting providers more engaged in this area and recommending this more often to their patients? Is it a matter of really incorporating this into medical school curricula? Is it training mental health professionals that are already working with patients? How do you think about outreach, and what should providers do if they want to get started?
Providers have so much influence in this kind of work. What we've seen is that when providers are telling, for example, the payers and insurance company that this is a big deal and that this could really help a lot of their patients, that makes the insurance companies pay a little bit more attention and say, oh, maybe this is something that we can make billable or that we can cover. So I would say that for providers, like if this is something that's interesting to you, even if it doesn't exist at all, there are definitely some paths forward as far as making some initial partnerships and collaborations that can bring this to the fore. And then, yes, we've seen a lot of success with medical school curricula. There are some situations where medical students themselves, obviously, they might have a medical humanities curriculum where they themselves are going to museums to use like visual thinking strategies that make them better listeners and better attuned to their patients. And a lot of times we've seen that when medical students have their own interactions with the arts, they become more likely to think about how that could benefit their patients down the line. So that is something that we're seeing. And then also, just physicians and providers, mental health therapists talking to one another. Because like I said, there has been such a dearth of tools in the healthcare field for managing well-being, for managing meaning and quality of life, social connection. And when we think about the World Health Organization's definition of health, like they said, health is complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. And a lot of times in healthcare discussions, health discussions in general, in our society, we are really focused on that absence of disease. But most providers know that's, they sense, even if they're not articulating it this way, that's one half of what my patients need. And even if I could address the illness that they're experiencing, if that's like depression or anxiety, for example, I could give them some medication to address that. That doesn't make them wake up in the morning and be like, I definitely want to be here participating in my life. So that true. Is something else. And providers know that. And so having more open conversations about that, like the fact that this is a need that we see, this is a need that we have not been able to address. What can we collectively do about that? That's a beautiful conversation to have. And we've seen those kinds of conversations lead intuitively to a model of care that looks that either is or looks an awful lot like social prescribing.
I love that. It's exciting to hear. And it's such a great point you made about even letting medical students or clinicians in training engage in these activities themselves, encouraging them to also participate, because then they are maybe more likely to recommend it to others and to their patients. As a last question, I was hoping to touch on just any frameworks or field guides that you might recommend to listeners, whether they're on the payer side, provider side, community-based organizations that might be collaborating with prescribers. What, if any, resources are there on social prescribing?
Oh, I am so glad that you asked this question. Absolutely. Last year, I was glad to lead the development of a resource called Arts on Prescription, a Field Guide for U.S. Communities. And it's a very straightforward title. It's exactly what it sounds like. But we designed this field guide to it's not just information like, here's what Arts on Prescription is. Isn't that cool? It does offer you that. And then it's literally like a step-by-step guide for how would you implement this in your community. And we made it strategically for a combination of arts organizations and creative professionals and communities and healthcare providers. So those were our two main audiences. And then, of course, anybody in communities that's advocating for greater well-being. It can be patient advocacy groups, things like that. All of those are part of the readership of this guide, but we want to make sure that providers and arts organizations have this on hand so that they learn ways to partner with each other and ways to carry this out. So you can get that guide. The easiest way to get it is just tashagolden.com/field guide. You can grab it right there on my site. You can also probably find it by Googling it, but you could definitely get it at tashagolden.com/field guide. And then there are lots of other resources on my site and otherwise just about the general combination of arts and health, and specifically how arts and cultural engagement can affect our mental health. You can find so much there, and I'd be happy to hear from anybody and connect them with more information too.
I'm certainly going to check out those resources and learn more about this kind of emerging field in science. It's really exciting. So thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
In the next segment, Anastasia interviews Chris Appleton, CEO and founder of Art Pharmacy. Here they are.
Chris, it's great to have you on the show. I'm excited to talk to you about social prescribing today. And I think a good place to start is, what is social prescribing? Because a lot of people might not know what it is.
Social prescribing is a practice that has been around since the 1980s, through which healthcare providers prescribe non-clinical care to their patients. Think prescription for food, prescription for exercise, prescription for nature, or in Art Pharmacy's case, prescription for art and culture.
Why a prescription? Why is that necessary?
People trust their healthcare providers. There's something about the power of the prescription pad. I say all the time that when my brother tells me to exercise or my brother tells me to eat better, it gets one response. But when my doctor tells me to do something, I'm more likely to do it. And we know that the social element of care, especially in mental health, behavioral health, mental health disorders are biopsychosocial diseases. And that social leg of the stool is so important. But historically, U.S. healthcare hasn't addressed that social leg of the stool. And so by getting your healthcare provider to write that prescription, healthcare is better addressing the social leg of the stool.
How does a prescription work? Is there a list, a menu, so to speak, of different events that are happening in a community, and the provider is plugged into those and prescribes this concert on a Tuesday night or this museum membership? Or is it a little more broad than that?
In Art Pharmacy's model, the healthcare provider, in many cases it's a PCP or a behavioral health provider, writes a prescription for, let's say, 12 doses of arts and culture. And that prescription is called in via electronic referral, akin to how a prescription for a call for a prescription for an antidepressant gets called in to CVS or Walgreens. That prescription gets called into Art Pharmacy, and Art Pharmacy then builds a unique patient profile based on the member's clinical needs, social needs, access barriers, chief complaints, and then interest or experience related to arts and culture. And our technology then matches the member to the highest efficacy arts and culture engagement for that specific member.
And I'm curious, what is the body of evidence that supports a positive impact on mental health when it comes to arts and culture?
So the first thing I would suggest that listeners do is read a wonderful book came out last year by Ivy Ross at Google and Dr. Susan Mac-Salmon at Johns Hopkins called Your Brain on Art. And it's about neuroaesthetics, and it's about the art's impact on our brain. And for about 40 years, centers for arts and medicine, arts and health at Harvard and University of Florida and UCLA and the World Health Organization and really across the globe have studied the art's impact on our health and well-being. And the evidence is very clear that engaging with arts and culture can improve our health. It's strongest around mental health, but it also can impact our adherence or compliance to chronic disease management programs. It can reduce stress levels, cortisol levels. The arts are a powerful tool for healing. And if this sounds odd to folks, the example that I like to give is 30 years ago, we didn't all know that our health outcomes were connected to our physical activity level. Now, of course, saying that sounds silly. Of course, we know that our health outcomes are connected to our physical activity level. But 30 years ago, that wasn't true. And then out came Silver Sneakers, a national network of fitness programs, physical activity programs for older adults. More or less, everybody on a Medicare plan or MA plan has access to Silver Sneakers or a competitor of it. Because Of course our health outcomes are connected to our physical activity level. In 10 years, we're all going to be sitting around saying, remember when we didn't know that our health outcomes were connected to our engagement with arts and culture?
Are there any conditions, mental health conditions, for which something like a prescription for an arts and culture dose is just not enough?
Many people need to be on medications. Many people need to be in psychotherapy, talk therapy, CBT, intensive treatment. And so it's not an either or. Just like for someone with hypertension, it's not take this med or exercise or eat better. It's take this med, exercise, and eat better. For someone with an anxiety disorder or depression disorder, it's not take this med, depending on the severity, right? It's not the acuity. It's not take this med or be engaged in arts and culture. It's comply with your treatment plan, and your treatment plan should be designed to your specific needs and profile.
I'm curious, in the conversations that you have had with providers, to what extent is this something they're aware of or on board with? Because personally, between myself and all of my friends who have sought mental health treatment, I have never heard of something like this. And I feel like that might be the case nationally.
I think it's especially true for what you've experienced. I think it's especially true for younger folks. For the older adult population, when we go talk to PCPs and invite them into our network to partner with us, they say, oh yeah, I've been doing this for 30 years. Maybe not formally, but have informally been encouraging their patients that are socially isolated, lonely, late life depression, be connected to community. They've been doing that for a long time. We get very little resistance, if any at all, from providers when we invite them to participate in our program. They may or may not know the science of why arts engagement can improve health outcomes, but no one questions whether or not it's beneficial on a Saturday afternoon to participate in a dance class, to go with your child or friend or loved one to the theater, to go to a painting workshop. We don't get challenged around that. It's human nature to know that these things are good for us.
Well, that's good to hear that providers are on board. What about the payers? How is this getting paid for? And how would a patient be able to access this if they can't afford it out of pocket?
We've had some early traction with payers are looking for solutions, especially in the Medicaid and Medicare populations, that can address time to care challenges. There's just more demand for mental health and behavioral health interventions than there is traditionally available supply. It's just simple economics. And they're looking for solutions. So we have had some early traction. But of course, as should be the case, part of the consideration for the payer is really demonstrating reduction in emergency department visits, cost of care, the things that really move the needle for them, in addition to the clinical outcomes for their members. And so we're glad to have partnerships where we're pursuing those outcomes.
Well, that leads me to my next question. I was really curious to hear how you are tracking someone's progress who has gotten a prescription. It seems like from the get-go, they're engaged in a digital way with you guys because you're figuring out their preferences and tailoring these prescriptions to fit their lifestyle or their preferences. So what is the typical journey like? Like, how long does it take for them to get better, and how do you measure that improvement?
So our pharmacy uses validated standard behavioral health assessment tools, PHQ, GAD, the UCLA Loneliness Scale, WHO-5, where we get baseline data on the member essentially at intake when they come into the art pharmacy. ecosystem, and then after each dose of arts and culture. So the average treatment plan is 12 doses of arts and culture over a 12-month period. And there's research that is the foundation of that. Study by Dr. Daisy Fancourt at a University College London showed longitudinal study showing that sustained ongoing engagement in arts and culture reduces isolation loneliness, boosts connection, belonging, and emotional well-being. And so it's really, in part, from a foundational standpoint, it's about that sustained regular engagement, sort of like exercise. It's not like you've got to go climb Mount Everest. It's not like you got to go, you know, run a marathon. It's just being regularly engaged. And so Art Pharmacy is getting that baseline data on the member. And then after each dose of arts and culture, we assess the member. So we're able to measure the impact of a specific intervention, as well as the sustained impact of a treatment plan and the ongoing engagement in these types of activities for the member. Mm-hmm.
And what are some of the results that you've seen?
We've been very pleased with results thus far. We have over an 80% engagement rate for members. So 82% of members that have been referred to Art Pharmacy complete intake and participate in at least one dose of arts and culture. We have a really high adherence rate, adherence to the treatment plan, 75%. That's nearly twice the adherence rate of SSRIs or antidepressants. Again, as I said earlier, this isn't to say Art Pharmacy instead of antidepressants. This is just to demonstrate this is a patient preferred. This is a patient preferred intervention. People want to be doing those things. People don't want to be on meds. People don't want to sit in the psychotherapist's office. Maybe they need to, but they don't want to be doing those things. These are things that people engage with and adhere to. 73% of our members have shown clinical improvement in, as measured by behavioral health assessments in their treatment with Art Pharmacy. And then one of the other things that we really love, this gets back to your question around the providers, how do the providers respond? When the provider has their toolkit of resources and what they're historically able to offer their patients are meds and maybe a referral to a psychiatrist or a therapist, that has a certain impact. But when the provider is able to refer their patient to these life-enriching, patient-preferred, creative interventions, it boosts the provider well-being. Providers enjoy participating in this. It improves the quality for them as well.
And what about beyond the typical year-long participation in this? Do you think that if a patient sticks it out, does the program for a year, they build enough habit to continue that over the long term without needing to get a prescription every year?
We have seen outcomes where just a few months into the program, patients say, oh, love, bought my own membership to the local theater or the museum, and I'm doing this myself. Or I've joined a theater writing, playwriting group along with a couple of friends. And that they're developing, there's that behavior change, and they're developing those habits and practices themselves. Sometimes people just need to be opened to the available resources that are out there for them.
And I just want to be really clear, is Art Pharmacy currently only available through a health plan, or is this something that's also available to a patient out of pocket if it's not a part of their health plan?
It is available to patients out of pocket if it's not available to their health plan, through their health plan. And it's not only through health plans that it's paid for. We have a wonderful partnership with Stanford University, where Stanford students, both undergraduate and graduate level students, have access to Art Pharmacy as a health and wellness benefit. It's not the health plan that's paying for it there, it's the university. And so there's many types of third party payers. But yes, patients or members can pay for it and get access themselves.
You mentioned Stanford, and I wanted to ask, it got me thinking about medical schools or nursing schools. Do you find that this is something that is being taught to the next generation of workers, healthcare professionals?
Social medicine is certainly being taught to the next generation of healthcare providers. I was on a call earlier today with a nursing faculty member at University of Massachusetts that has been teaching this for several years. It's really happening. We have partners here in Atlanta at Emory University that are teaching this. So social prescribing is arriving, and it's still early. It's obviously very early, and it'll be interesting to say the least about how it plays out in the U.S. healthcare system. But the next generation of healthcare providers are increasingly aware of the importance of social care within the healthcare system.
Yeah, certainly something that I've been covering a lot on the health equity beat is the ways that the system is acknowledging the social determinants of health and all these companies and providers that are working together to coordinate social services and refer folks out to community-based organizations. So it's an exciting time, but I never really thought of arts and culture as being a part of that. In terms of the future of where this is going and how it's paid for, I wonder if this is more likely to fall under value-based care, risk-based arrangements rather than the traditional fee-for-service system. Is there a code right now to bill for this type of thing in the fee-for-service world?
I think it really does live in the value-based care space. And there are codes, you know, for which you can bill that get at some of the components of social prescribing. Certainly, there is not a code there's no CPT code for museum tickets or theater workshops.
That would be amazing.
But this kind of work is so well aligned with the value-based care model that says, let's get upstream, let's provide inexpensive, high quality, high engaged preventative and primary care and population health programs. That's really where this kind of work ought to live.
Well, this is all really exciting, has me feeling hopeful. And I hope that someday I'm lucky enough to get a prescription that is covered by my health plan. Chris, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Pod Gnosis. I'm Ayla Ellison. You can find out more about this topic in our show notes at fiercehealthcare.com. Look for podcasts. And don't forget to tune in every Wednesday morning to Pod Gnosis, where healthcare is our beat.